We're talking about it. This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson on 900 CHML.
Hey, it's Hamilton Today. I'm Curtis Thompson, Scott's son. Stomping Tom Craig is on the board, while Will Erskine booking the guests. In the legendary CHML newsroom, Dave Woodard and Jennifer McQueen. Here's Scott Thompson.
CHML. I'm Scott Thompson, Hamilton Today. Jump into the fun. Love to hear from you. 905-645-3221. Talk, text, leave us your last word. And don't forget that Hammerhead Trivia coming up after the 5 o'clock news. And your chance to help us tear another page off the Justin Trudeau countdown calendar coming up after the 4 o'clock news. And Stop and Tom on the board, play on the Aerosmith. The reason being, on this day in 1993, the comeback is complete as Aerosmith's Get a Grip album debuts at number one, making their first trip to the top of the album charts on this day back in 1993. As I mentioned, feel free to contribute. Love to hear from you. Lots of ways to do it. And, of course, a chance for you to win coming up a little later on. Two tickets to see Forge FC versus Vancouver FC. May 18th, Tim Hortons Field, and $100 at Lotto Max tickets. Dream to the Max. There you go. That's coming up after the 5 o'clock news. Speaking of Tim Hortons Field, and then, you know, if you're talking to Tim Hortons Field, you got to do 6 degrees of separation and eventually come up with the Tie Cats. And I probably shouldn't be saying this on the air. So anyway, my kid's in high school, and he's taking like a gym leadership course. And, you know, every so often they do this with all the kids. They bring them into MAC, and, you know, it's a great day, and they put them through the paces and do a program with them. So today, of course, in the stadium at MAC, at Ron Joyce, the Tie Cats are practicing. So he was like, look at this, man. Look, the Tie Cats are here practicing. Woo, woo, woo. And then, of course, they come over and said, hey, you know what? You're more than welcome to watch, but you can't be taking pictures. Okay. So don't be doing that. But, yeah, pretty cool. And pretty cool for, the kids to get to see that this afternoon, at McMaster University. All right. I said to him, did you see the protest? No, we didn't see it. So clearly they are more on the athletic side of the place, as opposed to, you know, the science buildings. All right. I digress. We got a jam packed show. Hope you hang around for it. Love to see you, and be a part of it as the ways we've just, we've talked about, coming up. We're going to talk to, an interesting article that came out in the Toronto Star. Canada's immigration point system is flawed. A new report says here's how they propose to fix it. And it's fascinating because, of course, Canada is a land of immigrants. I'm first generation Canada. My mother came here on the boat, as they said. And that's like, how many stories are there of that, especially in this city? So, and everywhere around Southern Ontario, Canada, pick your provinces. And so I think Canada and Canadians generally are supportive of immigration. But of course, over the last couple of years, we're seeing like 1.3 million new Canadians a year. And this was the economic policy for the government. And of course, I don't know, it didn't work. And, not a lot of debate, research, I don't know. And of course, it taxed the housing system, taxed the healthcare system. It is still doing all of that, and right down to the shelter system that we see in parks across the land. So, you know, it's pretty clear that the situation needs to be fixed. It's interesting. The article is it flawed? I don't know. Could you take the immigration point system as flawed and perhaps put in the word broken? But I guess it's irrelevant as long as we're examining the problem, right? Or perhaps in order to do that, understand how severe the problem is. Well, it's so severe, you don't have to look at the housing, immigration, and shelter system that we're talking about. The government backtracked on two of the situations regarding temporary workers and international students, capping their own targets. which I'm not sure has gone into effect yet. So definitely the system is at least flawed and most likely broken, I would say. And, you know, again, as we have more and more people coming in and working for the federal government, from 30% to 40% increase since this government took power, still issues with things like passports and what have you. So, you know, simply, you know, the right hand does not know what the left hand is doing. And then we hear that one of the three suspects that was arrested in the allegedly murdering the Sikh activist in British Columbia was in on a temporary student visa and had been here for a couple of years, and no real sign of using that for that purpose. So yeah, the system is flawed. And, you know, to be totally honest and forthright, I don't think there's a system within this government that isn't flawed. Now you could say, well, it is in every government. Yeah, it is, but you know, not to the extent that we're seeing now. And, you know, again, whether it's immigration, whether it's election interference, whatever it is, I mean, it's just, you know, we've just lost focus here on basic management issues of the country and focused everything on saving the planet for the last 10 years. As we contribute our volatile 1.5% of greenhouse gases to the world. So fascinating place to be. And again, the great news is Canadians are finally figuring it out. We'll talk about that coming up a little later on this hour as well. Parents going in on home ownership with their kids in order to assist the kids in getting into the market. You know, this was I guess, going on 10, 20 years ago. And then it was kind of viable, but, you know, a pretty dicey situation to do now. We'll talk about that coming up a little later on. Also, going to talk about Canada Post. They're in the news again about how they move forward and what the future is. We'll talk to Dr. Ian Lee about all of this a little later on in the show. And what else we got? More surveys from Leger and what your thoughts are on the protests we're seeing in cities and in campuses across the land. We'll talk about that coming up. The Toronto Star reporting Canada's immigration point system is flawed, a new report says, and interesting take. And again, we talked about this just before, just as the show was starting. Here's what the article says. Canada should revamp its immigration point system to better select those with the skills to boost productivity, any report says, even if the changes might favor applicants from some countries. Immigration has long been premised on newcomers being the engine of the economic growth and prosperity, said the study by the Business Council of Alberta, but cracks have emerged with Canada's recent population surge, which has magnified challenges in housing, healthcare. We've seen it right the way across the board. To talk more about all of this, Cassandra Faltz is with us, regulated Canadian immigration consultant, Doherty Faltz Immigration Consultants, and here now. Cassandra, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Hey, Scott. Great to hear from you.
How has our system changed in the last few years? Is it relatively been stable, or has it changed a lot, say, since pre-pandemic?
It's a great question. The biggest change is really with the advent of Express Entry, which is the current iteration of the point system that Canada is famous for. Now, that came out in 2015. So we've been with that for nearly a decade now. However, lots of things have happened between then and now, lots of changes. But what we've seen since the pandemic is that nothing has gone back to normal. Nothing is as it is expected to be. And the results that we're getting from this system are not favorable to Canada as a whole, or to newcomers, or to Canadians.
So how does the point system work, and why does that not work for us now?
So I think that the reason it's not working now is because, frankly, we have to keep up with the times, right? 10 years ago in 2024, it's like a dinosaur age. Like, we have to keep up with the times, and this government has not done that at all. We haven't dealt with the fact that that everything changed with the pandemic, and we haven't dealt with the fact for who's coming to Canada now. We haven't dealt with the healthcare worker shortage. We haven't dealt with the trades worker shortage. And frankly, the changes that have been made to sort of address those issues have really been a little bit too little too late.
So with the point system, what basically in layperson's terms, as you're saying, is we need to adjust how you accumulate points in the system more geared towards what we need, whether it is trades, whether it is family doctors, what have you.
Absolutely. 100%. There's a couple of issues at play. One is how you accumulate points. I'm thinking of one gentleman I have right now who's a client. He's in the express entry pool for quite some time at this point. He's got a score of 515 points. This is very high. And ask me what he does. He's a carpenter. He literally builds houses. He's been sitting in the pool for months, can't get an invitation to apply for permanent residence. It's crazy. I have another person, very similar. They've been in Canada for 10 years, went to high school here, went to university here, worked for the government here, and can't get an invitation to apply. The system is broken.
Who is getting the invitation to apply?
That's a great question. So in the general pool, different types of professionals are getting most of the invitations. And these are professions that really sort of lean on very high levels of education. Essentially, if you have a master's degree, you're in. If you have a PhD, you're in. And that's right. Great. That's great. Obviously, we need highly educated professionals. But I'm sorry, a PhD probably isn't building your house, right? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely. So how do we fix this? How do we realign this?
Well, it really comes down to being willing to change with the times frequently, more than once a decade, right? And also being prepared to be proactive, right? Seeing what's coming down the pipeline and not just doing wild knee-jerk responses when you see that your numbers are falling in the polls. That's what it's going to take. Actually being proactive and looking out for the interests of Canada, which encompasses the interests of both natural-born Canadians as well as newcomers. We all have the same interests, which is we don't want the GDP to fall, right?
So obviously you're pointing to the current government and the situation and the mass increase that we've seen. Of that mass increase that we've seen over the last couple of years, are those not the types, and being very general here, not the sort of occupations, what have you, that we need?
That's really the issue. You know, that's really the issue. Obviously, we need tech workers. We obviously need people to work in IT, but these are not the people who build homes. These are not right. The people who are, you know, taking your blood pressure and checking you into the hospital in the ER. Another issue is that there's a real challenge for especially healthcare workers, because let's imagine we have a healthcare worker who wants to come work in Canada. I get calls frequently from healthcare workers in America, right? American nurses, et cetera. They want to come work on a LMIA exempt work permit, usually under the old NAFTA agreement, which is still in place. But the issue is they can't get the work permit to work in a Canadian hospital or healthcare setting without getting the okay from the Ontario College of Nurses. Okay. But the Ontario College of Nurses can't give them the okay without them having the work permit. It's a vicious cycle.
Wow.
So we're only hurting ourselves with this, let's say, less than proactive approach, this overly regulated approach. Like, the point is we just need people to work here, right? So let's talk about, like, proactive and especially streamlined solutions that are not just rooted in more bureaucracy for bureaucracy's sake.
We need a more nimble system, it sounds like you're saying. Is that possible? Is that possible in government?
Well, we have to hope so. I mean, we're not just giving up the ghost here. Of course, yeah. It's possible. Absolutely. But we have to want it, right? The people in charge have to actually want this. They have to be willing to look down the pipeline 6 months, a year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, and consider how the decisions that they are making today are going to impact the country as a whole then, and even down to the next generation, because I'm telling you, these wild knee-jerk reactions you're seeing with these, you know, huge sweeping changes, this is a reaction. It's a reaction to public opinion falling on the current government's approval ratings, and also a reaction to public opinion falling against immigration. right? People have sort of taken for granted that immigration is a good thing. But these days, people don't feel that way. And we can all understand why.
Yeah. And, you know, Cassandra, you point out a problem that I think that exists with a lot of situations here, in that we just don't seem to be doing the homework before we make decisions. And then when we do, they stick for a long time. We're not thinking that, you know, every 5 years we need to reexamine housing, every 2 years, every, you know, same thing with this. Every few years, this needs to be updated.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what's really important, too, is that the feds, the people making these decisions, they need to get information from people with boots on the ground, not from up in the ivory tower where, you know, no one in a 2 mile radius has ever even filled out a visa application. Like, they need to see, how is this really going to impact us? And we all know, like, I believe we even discussed it a few weeks ago, how the current government ignored that report on how immigration was going to impact the economy, and especially housing and healthcare. Just ignored it. You can't just ignore things that don't favor the decisions you're making.
Cassandra Fultz with us, regulated Canadian immigration consultant, founder of Doherty Fultz Immigration Consultants, on an immigration system that needs adjusting. It's flawed. Cassandra, thanks for the time. Good luck.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Scott.
Obviously, affordability, housing, all of that, issues for people just across the board, across the country, every demographic. And when it comes to home ownership, it's more and more difficult for people to get on board, not only with the lack of supply, but then the cost once they get there. Parents going in on home ownership with their kids in order to assist the kids in getting into the market. This is a little bit different, I think, than helping them out with a down payment. Let's bring in Don Fox, executive financial consultant, the Fox Group, IG Private Wealth Management, and listen to Planning Your Financial Future every Saturday morning right here. Don, thanks for the time. I hope you're doing well.
Doing great, Scott. And yourself?
I'm doing well. Are you in Argentina right now?
I am looking over the Iguazu Falls in Argentina-Brazil border as we speak.
Nice. Very good. And is this fact-finding vacation or is this fact-finding financial consulting?
Well, fact-finding, I don't know where that comes into it, but let's go with that.
All right. So we talked about this in past shows and have talked about it, I'm sure we'll in the future again. Going in on home ownership, is that a little different than what you've seen in the past with parents trying to help out with a down payment? Are we talking about two different things here?
Yeah, it's a big difference. In the past, you'd see parents, you know, give, you know, $10,000 to $50,000 and maybe get a promissory note back from their kids just in case, you know, their partner or your spouse didn't work out. Now we're talking about co-owning a house or even, you know, putting the resources together and living in part of the house. So it's a, you know, big step up from the original way of doing things.
How does this change how you set this up? I mean, obviously, with any of this stuff, the devil's in the details. I'm sure sometimes it works, sometimes it can't work.
It's complicated. You're right, Scott. You know what? You know, there a recent poll, and it was looking at millennials and people born in the 90s. And basically, you're looking at people born in the 90s, one out of six homebuyers are getting a hand by their parents.
Yeah.
And so they're either owning a percentage. So what happens quite often is they'll take a 1% ownership of the house, which is really a non-financial. It's basically co-signing and allows them to, say, go from a $350,000 mortgage to, say, getting $1 million mortgage. So it qualifies for a lot bigger amount. But it does add some risk to the parents, particularly that bare trust that everybody had to fill out for co-owning with a parent or a child or anybody else. That was supposed to happen back in April 1st. It didn't end up happening, but doesn't mean it's not gone away. So it may come back again. So that whole tax return, but information grab, that may come back, but also a credit score. So when you co-sign on a mortgage, you're liable. So if they're, you know, if the child misses a payment, it affects your credit score.
Right.
And in fact, if they miss all the payments, you have to make the payment. So it is some risk, and you do have to have a good relationship with your kids to put it lightly.
Obviously, if you give money, there's ties to the money, like you said, a promissory note or whatever to pay it back. But this ties you to the actual investment, doesn't it?
Yes. You know, this is an interesting case because what you're seeing sometimes is, you know, the parents selling their house and having the kids live in one part of the house, say with their new spouse or common law partner.
Right.
And the parent or parents are living in the other part. That's all good when everybody's living happily together, but it also adds challenges. And what if there's a marriage breakup? And then what happens? Do the parents now have to find another house themselves? Do they just dissolve the whole thing? So yes, there's a lot of risks. So what you need to do is you really need to go in all the what ifs. So what if it doesn't work out? What if there is a divorce? What if there's a case where the parents don't want to deal with this anymore? So you need to have something in documentation just to help out. So it's all written down and there's no surprises. Everything works out great when it's working out great. But if it doesn't, that's when you need to fall back on something in writing.
So you're going to need a lawyer to look after not only the sale, buy, whatever it is that you're doing, the transaction. You're going to need to specifically look at this agreement and what the downfalls could be.
Precisely. In fact, this is where having a financial plan or planner, or both for that matter, to make sure it's even viable. And just to let people know, there is this risk. So, and what happens is the parents are the ones often taking some unnecessary risk that could jeopardize their own financial planning plan and their retirement plan. And you got to look at that and say, okay, is it worth it? Now, quite often, kids don't have a lot of choice. And this whole affordability is a real issue right now. And going back to you said originally, Scott, adding a little bit to a down payment is one thing, but sharing in the ownership of the house is a totally different story.
And talk about how it could affect your retirement plans or your nest egg. Because in a sense, Don, aren't you just giving it to them early?
Yes, you could be. And if you could even afford that. I know I've done this in the past. So if you were to say, okay, I'm going to give or lend $200,000 to my child, how does that affect my plan? I know in one particular case, it was less than that. And it put them from 100% retirement, you're fine, you're good, down to 65% because it wasn't that much wiggle room. And it ends up being more of an emotional decision. You always want to help your kids, but can you truly afford it? And so this is where you actually have to put this number. What if it doesn't work out? What if they can't afford to pay you back? And you may never see this money again. So as you mentioned, Scott, you're gifting it early, but can you really afford to gift it early?
And you have to wonder if somewhere down the road there isn't another tax. Like, you know, we were talking about capital gains and last week and passing fortunes on to your estate on to the next generation and such. Well, now after all of this, you even wonder if there's anything to pass along.
Well, you never know, too, because there's been a number of tax grabs of late, and particularly at the federal level. And if they start to see, you know, gifting money early, they may say, well, this should be part of the probate cost.
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe they'll be, you know, we want to have some of that money. If you're going to gift your money away, well, that would have normally gone through probate. And therefore, we want, you know, that would be on a provincial level, but we want 1.5% of that. And you never know because the amount of debt all governments are in, they're always trying to get innovative and they'll, you know, say, well, let's just pay your fair share or whatever slogan they use.
Whatever's fair, Don, it's all fair. All right. Don Fox with his executive financial consultant with the Fox Group, IG Private Wealth Management, home ownership with your kids. Get a good financial advisor and perhaps a lawyer, too, to help you with it. Don, thanks for the time. Enjoy Argentina.
Thank you, Scott. Anytime.
There's a lot of conflict going on in the world. And now we'll talk about Russia's war in Ukraine as that continues. Remember, that was just supposed to be a week-long operation. This week, it was announced that Russia would begin nuclear weapon drills after an angry exchange with senior Western officials. To talk more about all of this, Arl Brown is with us, Professor of International Relations, senior member at the Monk School of Global Affairs, University of Toronto, and here now. Arl, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
Thank you.
Arl, give us a bit of an update where we are now with this conflict. It's hard to keep it's hard to keep up to date with everything that's going on in the world. Where is this specific conflict now?
It is dragging on now for more than 2 years. As you noted, the expectation in Moscow was this was going to be over in a few days with a spectacular Russian victory and the entire collapse of Ukraine. That has not happened. But clearly, the Russians are inflicting a great deal of damage on Ukraine, and they have made some advances in the east. But it is essential to look at the big picture always, because that is what gives us the strategic vision. That is something that allows us to understand what the larger trend lines are. And in those terms, even though clearly Russia has certain advantages, it is not winning. And when Russia is not winning, essentially it is losing, because it put its reputation online. It has invested the best of its resources. It has lost vast numbers of people. It is continuing to lose huge numbers. And despite the many, many advantages that Russians have, the West has been very slow to react. When we look at the specifics, their advances in Avdiivka, or what they're trying to do around Chasiv Yar, they have enjoyed only limited success, which is not to dismiss that. This is not to suggest that there is no continuing danger, that the West doesn't need to step up. But it is very important not to go from overblown optimism to dark pessimism.
Certainly not the first time we've heard of nuclear weapons announcing Russia would begin nuclear weapon drills. Is there any depth to this, or is this just more saber rattling as we've seen every so often with this conflict?
It is saber rattling. The Russians understand that no one would win in a nuclear war, and that they cannot fight a nuclear war. And in fact, that is the only area where they have some kind of equivalence with the United States, because otherwise Russia is nowhere near to being a superpower. It does not even have an economy that matches that of Germany alone. So they are trying to use this kind of nuclear exercise to intimidate the West, to play on the instincts of people in the West, people fearing nuclear war rightly. It is rational to try to avoid mass destruction. But the Russians also understand what the consequences would be for Russia. And this is where there's a huge difference between, let's say, the fanatical theology of the leadership in Iran, which could be very unpredictable in its behavior with nuclear weapons, versus Russia under Vladimir Putin, who loves the life of luxury that he has, the pomp and circumstance. He is most definitely not suicidal.
It seems every few weeks, every few months, he brings something like this up. Is this, again, just part and parcel? Why do you have to do it every few weeks? They talk about the West deepening roots in Ukraine. Does that simply mean that they're just still funding this? They're still standing behind them?
Putin is trying to throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. He's making conventional threats. He is making nuclear threats. He is reacting to Macron's statement, which was not very well thought out, that at some point maybe NATO would need to go into Ukraine. There's no intention to do that on the part of NATO. They need to send more ammunition, more weapons, which slowly they're beginning to do, but they have been laggards. The Europeans are rearming now. The Americans have approved the very large aid package. It takes some time. The Biden administration should have acted much more quickly, much more decisively before, but it is grinding on. And when we look again at the big picture, we now have Sweden and Finland in NATO. We now have Germany spending massively on the military. We now see the decision having been made to provide Ukraine with F-16 fighter planes, which will take a little bit more time. But Ukraine will now have at least a small air force that can fight back. So the long-term prospects for Russia are not great. And this is why Russia tried to deal Ukraine a knockout blow. They wanted to have something that would be spectacular before May 9th, which is the celebration of Victory Day, when Nazi Germany surrendered unconditionally to the Allied forces. Actually, it was on May 8th, but it was already nighttime in Russia. Well, they're not achieving that. So we have instead the threats coming from Russia, the pretense, the manipulation, the use of so-called reflexive control, which is a KGB technique of trying to influence people by playing on their fears and predilections in the West. We have all of that, but Russia continues to incur massive losses. They have a large army, but they don't have an infinite supply of soldiers. When they took Avdiivka, for instance, they lost something like 17,000 soldiers dead and wounded. That is not sustainable in the long term. Hmm. This is not the Soviet Union in the Second World War. They do not have the Soviet Union's population. They have less than half of that. And people in Russia do not have four or five children. They have one or two. And now we're beginning to see stirrings where people begin to question what is happening to their sons, what is happening to soldiers who are missing. And that is slow, but it is corrosive and ultimately damaging.
R.O. Brown with us, professor of international relations, senior member of the Monk School of Global Affairs, University of Toronto, University of Toronto. The Russia war in Ukraine continues, as saber rattling and more threats of nuclear war. But again, saber rattling. R.O., thank you as always. Be well.
Thank you.
Scott Thompson isn't satisfied with an answer.
He'll delve into the issue until he is.
You're listening to Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
Theft and robbery reportedly daily occurrence for many LCBO locations. We remember that horrific wrong-way chase on the 401 originated with a robbery at an LCBO location in Bowmanville, I believe. To talk more about all of this, Hank Azigna is with us, retired inspector with the Toronto Police Service, former homicide investigator, 34 years with the service and here now. Hank, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Scott, thanks for having me on. Hope you're doing well as well.
So far, so good. Hank, why are LCBOs such easy targets?
Well, I think the open shopping concept certainly doesn't help. The high value of the merchandise on open display and the ability to grab it off the shelves and get it out of the store without being stopped makes it an easy target for criminals. And, you know, LCBO backed down on their enforcement a few years ago, and now they're paying the price. And we're seeing a huge amount of losses, especially for an industry that is government owned and generates billions of dollars of revenue each year. I can't even imagine what their shrinkage numbers are.
And I'm guessing, Hank, that the bad guys know this is an easy target. They're not going to be bothered. So they're a little bit more brazen. They have no fear of this.
Yeah. I mean, if you walk into your local drugstore, Scott, and you see the razor blades, for instance, which run about $20, $25 a pack, they're behind a secure glass on the shelves to prevent the theft. And then you walk into the LCBO where bottles are anywhere from $50 to $150 that are on display. I mean, they'll lock up the expensive scotches, but short of that, so you can grab anything off the shelf and just walk out of it. So why proper environmental security measures aren't being put in place, I don't know. But I certainly think that's something that the LCBO should be looking at. It'll save us all a lot of money down the road.
Do we need to go back to the day where, you know, you go up to the counter, you fill out your pad of paper, then hand it to the person behind the counter?
Well, I don't know if we have to get that severe, and you're dating yourself. I remember those days
I didn't do it, Hank. I just watched my dad do it.
Yeah, no, I know. And the beer store was the same, right?
Yeah.
Now it's a one big open cooler, and it's a little harder to walk out with a full case of beer because it's a little more difficult to carry. But I mean, some of these guys are going into the LCBO with backpacks and huge shopping bags and carts and filling them up and just walking out again. So I don't think we need to go back to the slips. People like to browse and shop in their LCBOs, but certainly better control measures. We know they tag some of the bottles. Infamously, some police officers have actually been caught as a result of bottles being tagged with shoplifting offenses themselves. But that's very difficult to follow up on and enforce in the aftermath of the theft.
And employees are told to stand down when something like this happens, right? That's for the safety of everyone.
Yeah, and that's great advice. It's not worth getting yourself stabbed or shot or beaten in, you know, for several hundred dollars worth of merchandise. But the more you give them that space, you know, you give them an inch and they're going to keep pushing it and eventually be taking a mile. So the enforcement piece has to be there. The prevention piece has to be there. And, you know, the technology has to be leveraged where you can prevent these things from happening in the first place. And I think the cost of implementing things like that are going to be less than the actual loss that they're experiencing now.
All right, Hing, I can't let you go without asking you your thoughts on what started as an LCBO robbery in Bowmanville and then led to a wrong-way crash on the 401. Can you update us on that in any way, your thoughts on what transpired?
You know, I can't update you. I'm not privy to the internal workings of the SIU investigation, unfortunately. But I'll point out one thing. This there's a distinct difference between theft and robbery. And this started out as a theft. And under the criminal code, by virtue of the suspect pulling out a knife as he was trying to escape, it does make it a robbery. At least that's the appropriate charge. But the courts probably wouldn't recognize that at the end of the day at a contested trial and revert back to probably being a theft under $5,000 and maybe an assault with a weapon. So if you really think about it, is that crash and that pursuit worth what started out as a theft under $5,000 charge? It definitely isn't. And I think the consensus really is, you know what, if you can conduct that pursuit safely on city streets, there's definitely a need and a risk to public safety that necessitates the suspect being brought into custody. But once he makes that turn onto the 401 and is going the wrong way, that's tough to justify continuing that pursuit. So we'll see what the SIU comes up with. You know, they tend to take quite a while. I would think 6 to 8 months down the road before we might see a result from their investigation. It's going to be a big investigation. And we'll see what the professional standards unit at Durham Regional Police also has to say about it.
If, for example, Hank, and this is hypothetical, obviously, which is tough to do, but if somebody, if instead of a knife, the person had a gun, it changes the story.
It does change the story. And remember, these are all factors that that go up and go down as the incident unfolds. And these are things right. That the officers who are involved in the pursuit have to consider. So these are split second decisions that can turn on a dime, you know, depending what information they're getting over the radio, depending what the original call comes over as. You know, I highly doubt the call came over as a attempt theft under just occurred. It probably came over as a robbery, a suspect armed with a knife. And now we know in hindsight as well that this suspect was ready on charges for several other thefts and one robbery charge. So I don't think the pursuing officers would have had that information, but it really creates two separate issues, doesn't it? It creates the issue about the pursuit and whether that was justified. It also creates the issue and the question about why was this fellow out on bail?
Hank Insigno with us, retired inspector with the Toronto Police Service, former homicide investigator, commenting on LCBO robberies and, of course, that horrific 401 chase. Hank, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
My pleasure, Scott. Take care.
You're listening to the Hamilton Today podcast from 900 CHML.
Former NDP leader, federal NDP leader, Tom Mulcair writes for CTV, Trudeau's handling of Polyev's wacko house turfing, a clear sign of Liberal desperation. The first paragraph, when all hell broke loose in the House last week, those of us who have experience as parliamentarians simply couldn't believe our eyes. Speaker Greg Fergus had tossed out the leader of His Majesty's loyal opposition, Pierre Polyev, on the flimsy of pretenses. Fergus is highly partisan. We all know that when Trudeau backed him in the election to replace Anthony Rota, who'd been forced to step down after introducing a former Nazi soldier into Parliament. Skipping down after the election of Poilievre, it was gloves off ejection of Poilievre. It was gloves off for Trudeau and company. They put on a full court press worthy of a war room in the middle of a campaign. They clearly thought they had finally caught a break in their holy war against the evil Poilievre. To talk more about all of this, Larry Deani is with us, former mayor of City of Hamilton and here now. Larry, it's great to have you on the show and talk politics that doesn't involve the city.
Well, all politics involves the city.
I know. It's always fun to have you here. So what are your thoughts of what Thomas Mulcair has said and just the whole thing that went down the other last week?
Well, I should preface my comments by saying that I actually went and watched and listened to Poilievre when he was in Hamilton last Friday.
How was that?
I was there along with a number of people. He came to the New Italian Center, I was invited to go and listen to him. And so my son and I went. And I got to tell you, I was not impressed. But maybe we'll get into that as well.
Okay.
However, in terms of the and I should say, by the way, that Poilievre was crowing about the fact that he got kicked out for calling Trudeau a wacko and repeated it any number of times, quite a few times, Friday evening as well. He was very proud of it,
and did so on this show as well. Yes.
Well, there you go. So you know, it's a tempest in a teapot. It really is, the whole thing. I mean, a question period is theater, as we know. Real questions are never asked. They're usually gotcha questions by the opposition, whoever's in the opposition. And the government side never really answers. They always give the spin that they want to spin. And then it's up to us as voters and citizens to try to interpret that, and people like yourselves and other experts to try to interpret that for others as well. I don't know. I mean, wacko is a fairly mild expletive. Certainly not something that adds decorum to any situation, I'm sure, but not the worst of sins. I mean, I remember someone close to the prime minister who said fuddle duddle in question period one time. I don't think he was ejected. It really is a tempest in a teapot. What's more important to me, though, is this, that politics has become so toxic that you've got to go for the jugular all the time. And Pierre Poilievre was very good at this, by the way. He did it for the 25 minutes that I listened to him the other night. It was all red meat. It was all, blaming Trudeau for everything. Not in grown toenail, but I'm sure he didn't think of that. Blaming him for traffic accidents and, drugs and all of the worst things that our society has to offer, all at the feet of Trudeau. And, of course, Trudeau has learned this guy is out to get him. Hello. And he is trying to respond in kind whenever he's asked. He's never very complimentary about Mr. Poilievre either. And that is the sad state of affairs, as far as I'm concerned, rather than this incident. And that, by the way, it was the speaker who threw him out. It wasn't Trudeau.
Yeah.
Mulcair says that it was orchestrated. Well, Mulcair contradicts himself in that article, which I just read, because on the one hand, he says, to the accusation that Poilievre wanted to be thrown out, it was a spontaneous comment that was made, says Mulcair, and I believe that it was. And yet, if it was spontaneous, how can it be orchestrated by the other side? I think all of it was spontaneous. And the speaker felt that it was unparliamentary, and he exercised his role as speaker. And of course, it could have been handled by Mr. Poilievre in a different way, but he just doubled down, and what happened happened. What also was a bit of a show is that all of the conservatives also left, and all of the liberals. And by the way, they left, got on their phones and started appealing for money, apparently. They got quite a few. In fact, some of them taunted the liberals, saying, what are you guys doing? You're going to earn us a couple more $1 million by your antics on your side. So, I mean, the whole thing screams of a not serious way to handle the country's problems.
All right. And I've had this comment with you before, Larry. I don't think it's the leader of the opposition that sets the tone for the country. It's the prime minister. And I think this prime minister is the most divisive, and certainly in my history. And I think what people admire about Polyev, even if the game is the game of BS, finally, there's someone that can beat Trudeau at his own game. And I think that the message is resonating more than the prime minister's is at this point. And for the longest time, that hasn't been the case. But where does this go from here? Because what we're seeing moving forward, when the budget fell flat and so on and so forth, that now they keep trying to just, and I remember seeing the pundits on TV say this, or even consultants say, you know, they got to go after Polyev personally. They got to attack him. They got to unveil what he's really like. And, you know, whether that's, tying him to some extreme right-wing U.S. person or what have you, is that going to work?
I said this initially, right, that politics has become so toxic and personal.
Yeah.
And it's not just a battle of ideas. It's who can do the most damage to the other personality in a very personal way. Paul Yever's wife got into it. I mean, I remember she tweeted something claiming that Trudeau's father was Fidel Castro. This is Paul Yever's wife who said this.
Is that from an accurate source, though, Larry?
Well, it was a tweet that I saw attributed to Mrs.
Yeah.
Paul Yever.
Yeah.
So it's not something that brought honor to her. I don't
know.
I commented on that, and in fact, a former host of talk radio on your station reprimanded me for not being kind to her for spreading that or repeating that story. So
uh-oh.
It's become my point. Yeah, and it was. It wasn't Bill Kelly. Senior moment right now.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah, the point is that things have gotten to the level where it's all about bringing people down personally.
Yeah.
And that is just not the way politics should be played. It should be played at a higher ground. I mean, the prime minister, I mean, you say that he's the most divisive person. I mean, that would be an interesting conversation to have. To see some examples of that, but even if he's doing it, he's wrong. If he's doing it, you have to talk about ideas and elevate those ideas in debate, even ideas that you disagree with, because that's what inspires Canadians, not name calling.
All right. Well said. We'll get back to those other debates over time, Larry. Larry Deanny, former mayor, city of Hamilton, talking about politics in general. Always fun, Larry. Thank you for the time. Be well.
Thank you.
We know that there was the report out from the commissioner involving election interference, the inquiry into the election interference in the last two federal elections, and interesting comments coming up. For their protection, immigrants critical of China in India call for speedy passage of Canada's foreign interference legislation, as well as things like election interference. We don't realize that it is people that have come here from some of those countries that are actually being harassed by their homeland. To talk about where we are with this foreign interference legislation, and is there anything that can be added to it to strengthen it, considering the government initially didn't even want to hold a inquiry into this. Let's bring in Neil Bison, director with the Global Intelligence Knowledge Network, former CSIS officer, and here now. Neil, thank you for the time. Hope you're well.
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Neil, what stands out for you coming out of at least this first report of this inquiry? Are you finding out more than you thought you would, or confirmation of?
I think it's confirmation of a lot of things that I was under the impression was happening anyway. I mean, since this started, a while back, we were looking at different reports that had come out, the original one from David Johnston, and then how that was turned into something that became the public inquiry. So the latest report, I think, does a good job of setting the foundation for exactly how widespread foreign interference is and how it's been affecting Canadians, electoral system, and politicians.
announced that the safety minister announced that they will be going ahead with a foreign registry, something that's been called on for a long time. Many concerned the devil in the details. Are you concerned that this may not receive the attention that it needs?
No, again, I think this is another good first step. This basically shows that Canada is willing to put it out there to say that if those individuals who want to be part of the influence when it comes to decisions that are made by politicians, they need to be registered so that we're not dealing with any sort of deceptive or clandestine works when it comes to representatives of foreign governments who basically aren't willing to provide who they actually are. And it also, I think, helps the diaspora groups be able to fight back when it comes to any form of intimidation or coercion.
So many said, certainly at the beginning of all of these concerns, that if you bring up issues such as this, it was racist. However, now we're hearing from immigrants coming from those countries who are really being threatened, whether it's here or back home. What does it say when you have citizens that have become Canadians that are speaking up?
I think this shows that a lot of people who may not necessarily understand if they haven't immigrated to Canada is that by having friends, family, and other individuals that you're in contact with still living in the country that you immigrated from, that is a potential pressure point that can be used by foreign governments to try to coerce you into making decisions that you might not necessarily make when it comes to, elections or who you're going to back when it comes to a candidate. So I think it's good that we're seeing now that individuals that are from different diaspora groups are given more of an opportunity to voice what's happening to them.
How dangerous is it for them to speak up?
Well, I think that's the whole point of having a robust security and intelligence system is that, Canadian Security and Intelligence Services has been around for 40 years now. Before that, it was the RCMP Security Service. When it comes to ensuring that human sources and the ways and techniques that we use to communicate with those individuals are at the highest level of basically security intelligence, I think that gives them a bit of a reason to realize that, and the inquiry has shown this too, like a lot of that information has not been either exposed, passed on, and the report itself said that that is the reason why, because we need to protect these individuals. We need to protect their ability to speak with us so that we can collect this intelligence information and prevent more of this from happening.
You're a former CSIS officer, Neil. What can be done to improve, or do there need to be improvements in the relationship between CSIS and government? Is there new protocol that needs to be designed there?
Well, I think one of the things that they talked about was that now the Canadian Security Intelligence Service is going to have the ability to share its information beyond a broader reach than just the federal government. And I think that's really important because foreign interference isn't just something that's happening to our political and electoral systems. It's also happening when it comes to intellectual property. It's coming to academia. It's also coming into private businesses. So the fact that the Canadian Security Intelligence Service now has the ability to share information beyond a very specific breadth of just the federal government, I think that makes it a big deal.
Neil Bison with us, director with the Global Intelligence Knowledge Network, former CSIS officer, talking about foreign interference and the legislation that could potentially guard against it. Neil, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Take care. Thanks for having me.
When there's an issue, Scott is all in on getting to the heart of it.
This is Hamilton Today with Scott Thompson
on Hamilton's News, Today's Talk
900 CHML.
A new Leger survey suggests that nearly half of Canadians oppose the pro-Palestinian protest encampments that began more than a week ago, with students demanding their school publicize and end their investments in Israel defense companies. Andrew Enns is with us, Executive Vice President, Central Canada for Leger. Here now, Andrew, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Keeping well, Scott. Hope things are good with you as well.
So far, so good. How do Canadians feel about these protests? Is this specifically encampments in universities, or is this just generally, protests that are going on in various cities?
Well, this is we framed the question specifically about the university campus encampments that have been sort of springing up the last couple of weeks. We provided a little bit of kind of neutral context in terms of some of these that are going on in campus and the reason for them in terms of the war in Gaza. And we just asked whether Canadians support or oppose. And, you know, as the as we found in the poll, 48% of Canadians, you know, oppose the encampments, 31% are supportive, and another 20% are unsure. You know, it's still a developing issue in many parts of the country. So I'm not surprised by the somewhat higher number of, don't know responses.
Is this a situation where Canadians know the history of what is going down here, know the alternatives to or what the solutions may be, or is this a protest of the week?
Well, you know, in terms of how Canadians feel about the encampments, I actually, you know, when I think of the responses to the survey, I'm not sure that Canadians out there in the rank and file know exactly what the students are necessarily demanding or what exactly universities are able to do when it comes to addressing these demands. I think Canadians are sort of looking at this and going, I mean, there's a form of protest and we accept that as a freedom of speech, but I think it's starting, some of these encampments, I think, start to push things a little further. And I think there is some support in the general population to the voice that for other Canadians, other university students on campuses, this may not be a welcome event. It actually might be somewhat intimidating. And I think that's where it starts to become problematic for Canadians.
You talk about whether Canadians are really that engaged in with what the details of this are really about. Do the students know the answers to those questions? Or again, is it just, you know, it's hip to do this, let's do this, as opposed to what is the alternative? What is the solution? How do you move this forward? Is this a peace protest or is it about victory?
Well, yeah. Boy, that's a pretty it's a pretty deep question, Scott. I mean, I'll be honest, I'm not sure what the level of detail in terms of knowledge students have. I mean, yeah, you know, it seemed when it started in McGill, there seemed to be some very specific demands, and it gave the sense that, okay, maybe they know something that that the school's investing in, or perhaps different arrangements. The way they're popping up now, I mean, we have one that surfaced here in Manitoba at the University of Manitoba yesterday. The demands by students were pretty vague, and I'm not sure, like, I'm not aware of what the University of Manitoba, what sort of investments or relations it has with institutions in Israel. And so I suspect that as this movement, we'll see where it goes, but if it spreads, it may be becoming more of a movement to just show support, solidarity with others, and maybe not exactly, you know, grounded in sort of real specific demands.
Do you think if this grows, people will start making comparisons to the Freedom Convoy in Ottawa?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've heard a couple of, anecdotal sort of comments like that. And even, in response to our poll, just talking to a few people in the office in terms of, you know, obviously Freedom Convoy, it was very quickly, defined as very intimidating and threatening and sort of attracting kind of the wrong crowd. It'll be interesting to see whether or not there's any sort of parallels drawn. I mean, obviously, so far, I think the conduct's been reasonably good on the in these encampments, but but there is a concern that the longer these go, you have different elements participating in it. I mean, I have to say, I've got a university age daughter, and mm-hmm. she's not at university anymore. Like, school's done for her, and she's at home, so I'm not sure what sort of student activities on these campuses that'll be, maintaining these encampments if they go on, you know, for a prolonged period.
That was my next question, Andrew. The fact that school's out, does that change the dynamic? Because, again, the school year's over, no one's there. So who's protesting?
Well, you know, there's, I suspect there's some spring courses and maybe some summer courses, but and I think that for the institutions, I suspect that's a little bit on their mind. Like on one hand, you know, the disruption factor might actually, you know, who you're disrupting in terms of exams, or I suspect nearing the end here. So in terms of disruption, maybe that goes down as a concern. But I think if you're the institution, it's like, I mean, we just don't want this on our property for the entire summer. Like, I'm not sure what that, you know, what that begins to look like. And then what do you do? So there are going to be some questions, I think. In Manitoba, they've set a 3-day time period. It's supposed to end tomorrow. I guess we'll see if that happens. But it's McGill seems to be going on without any end in sight. So, you know, it'll be an interesting thing to watch unfold. And for Canadians who already aren't thrilled with it, I suspect longevity won't help matters.
Andrew ends with us, Executive Vice President, Central Canada for Léger. New survey from Léger suggesting nearly half of Canadians oppose the pro-Palestinian protest encampments on campuses. Andrew, thanks for the time and insight. Much appreciated. Be well.
Thanks, Scott. Have a good rest of your program.
Remember when Canada Post would have a strike? Maybe you don't. And it would literally cripple the nation. And it's amazing to see how far we've come and how far Canada Post has not. Obviously, courier services, what have you. And I remember when Canada Post would threaten to go on strike in the later days, just it seemed to drive more and more people to other methods of delivery. And now their annual report hinted that major changes could be in store to keep this company afloat, this corporation afloat. Dr. Ian Lee with us, Associate Professor, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University, here now, and actually worked with Canada Post for a short period of time. Ian, thanks for the time. Hope you're well.
Doing very well. Thank you, Scott.
So what is different between the conversations we're having today and maybe pre-pandemic or even a couple of years ago?
I'll try and summarize it in one single word that is very rich in meaning. Digitization or digitization of everything. And what we're witnessing, and this has been going on in many, many industries, broadcasting, magazines, newspapers, banking, and that is that anything that's informational, and people don't even, they say, well, I understand information, but I used to have these debates with my mother, my late mother, and I'd say to my mother, your ticket to go on Air Canada, it's on a piece of paper, that's information. You can digitize that. You do not need a piece of paper to board an airplane. It can be a digitized barcode in your cell phone. That's digitization. Everything is digitizing. Canada Post is an analog company that existed for over 200 years in the world of paper, delivery of paper, communication of paper, carrying of newspapers, carrying of invoices. Those days are dying or almost gone. The boomers grew up in that world. I did too. Our young people today are the most digitized people ever in human history. They live digitally. They think digitally. And Canada Post has not made the transition from that old world to the new world. It's quite similar to Blockbuster Video. So that people have an analogy. I mean, up until 10 or 12 or 15 years ago, we used to go to video stores and get videos. It was the normal, natural thing to do. We did it for 40 odd years. And then streaming came along and people said, well, I'm not going to drive down to the video store. I'll just sit at home and stream it. And so it literally destroyed that business. There's no video meaningful industry of video stores anymore. And so very quickly, Scott, just to put some big picture numbers out there so people know how bad the situation is. In 2006, the high water mark for letters in this country, letter mail, 7 billion pieces. So I'm not using dollars because the stamp prices can go up. I'm not playing games with inflation. 7 billion pieces. That meant that all of us, individual consumers and homeowners and renters and businesses, used the post office 7 billion times. Last year, we used it less than 2 billion times. That's a decline of 70%. Anybody out there listening, imagine if the company or the organization you work for lost 70% of its business, 70% of its volume, 70% of its customers. Just imagine. It's devastating. And the only solution is to transform and reinvent themselves to become parcel competitors in the parcel post space. But the problem is they're not competitive in parcels. We can talk about that in a moment. Mm. But the keep in mind that people say, well, you know, parcels, letters, it's the same thing, right? Completely different. The letter model, the business model for delivering of letters is very clear. You go down to every address of every street in Canada, 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year, yeah. 16.5 million residence addresses and business addresses. And you go there whether you have mail or not. It's called the Universal Service Obligation mandated by Parliament. That requires a massive organization, massive numbers of trucks, massive numbers of employees. Parcel post is a different business model. You only go to the address when you have a parcel to take there. People say, yes, I know that. Completely different model. A parcel post company doesn't need 60,000 people because you're not going to every address in Canada 5 days a week, 52 weeks a year.
Canada Post
has never made that transition.
Did Canada Post miss that opportunity? Because my question was going to be to you, you know, because some companies were able to transition during or digitize, some weren't. They were just just became obsolete. Did they miss their opportunity to do that? Is there has the model become obsolete, or is there another way?
I think they did, but I'll come to another way in a moment because it's not too late. But I think they're at the 11th hour and 59th minute. But just let me back up for a moment. The former CEO, Deepak Chopra, was trying to reinvent Canada Post as the essential partner of e-commerce in Canada. The new government came in, Mr. Trudeau, and I'm not trying to blame him or personally. I'm just saying they rejected him. They sent him packing. He was removed. I testified before the Blue Ribbon Panel in 2017, set up by the Trudeau government to analyze the future of Canada Post. I presented a scenario analysis very similar to what I'm saying to you now. Letter mail is in steep decline. Steep decline. The data shows this in the audited annual report. They've got to reinvent themselves now. And that commission and the Trudeau government, very clearly the minister, rejected any of those ideas that they got to reinvent themselves quickly and pivot away from letter mail. They said, no, we can do things like postal banking. We'll get some new customers. And CUPW supported this vision. The leadership of Canada Post supported this vision. And most importantly, the government of Canada supported this vision. They said, no, we're going to cancel the decision to cancel home delivery. We're going to keep delivering it to the most privileged neighborhoods in Canada, the Rosedales, the Glebe. Full disclosure, I live there. I get home delivery, and I shouldn't, by the way. And they said, we're not going to do any radical surgery to reinvent Canada Post. What they did, Scott, is they squandered 8 years of opportunity from 2015 to now to reinvent and face this inevitable digitization of everything. People knew in 2015 everything was digitizing. We all knew that. E-commerce had been around for 25 years at that point. But they missed it. And now the private courier companies have taken off and entrenched themselves. Mm-hmm. Canada Post can still do it, but it's going to be very radical what they have to do. I argue they have to close all the post offices, franchise them or close them, because people aren't going there and it's costing them almost $2 billion a year of costs to create, to open and staff and maintain post offices that nobody uses. It's a Potemkin post office. And they've got to stop going to 16.5 million addresses 5 days a week delivering mail that people are not sending in the post office. But they still are in denial. I've actually talked to senior people at Canada Post, and they say, yes, mail has collapsed, it's gone down, but now it's going to stabilize and plateau at 2 billion pieces a year. I want to put this on the record for all your listeners. No, it's going down at 8 to 10% a year. This is in the audited annual report, and I predict within 5 to 7 years, we will be down to essentially no letters mail in Canada. That is their core business. It's the business that's protected by monopoly under the Act of Parliament. Parcels are not protected. They have to compete, and they're not competitive. So they've got to do some very, very fast surgery to turn around and focus exclusively with those savings by closing 6,000 post offices, by canceling home delivery to the 25% of Canadians, the privileged Canadians that get home delivery, take that money and reinvest in parcels and become competitive, which will involve opening up the collective agreement because they're not competitive vis-a-vis the private firms.
Dr. Ian Lee with us, Associate Professor, Sprott School of Business, Carleton University, Canada Post, and the future of. Ian, as always, thanks for the time. Be well.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
Scott Radley Show coming up after the 6 o'clock news. Read him in your Hamilton Spectator. He is here now. Scott, thanks for the time. I hope you are doing well.
You know what, Scott? I was doing great until about half an hour ago.
Oh, no, what happened?
Well, I listened to the news.
Hey, a half an hour before showtime. That's getting the latest right there.
Well, I've been doing stuff all day, but
I'm kidding.
No, but I just caught this quote, this press conference from the head of the Public Service Alliance of Canada about how this is going to be a summer of discontent if our federal public service workers have to gasp, go back and work 3 days a week in the office. It's a breach of their human rights, Scott.
Is this include the new ones, the 30 to 40% that were hired? It's just in the last
38% increase in the size of our federal public service since Trudeau took over. 40% increase. Yeah. We now have something like almost 350, between 350 and 400, depending on where we are, 1,000 federal public workers. And for them to go back to the office, Scott, is a breach of their human rights. It's a staggering thing that our government would expect that its workers would get out of bed and go back to the office occasionally. Not even every day. Occasionally. This is, you know what? Forget the encampments and the protests at universities for Palestine. We're soon going to have them at Parliament Hill by employees, public service employees saying, I can't go back to the office. It's an outrage. Human rights are being violated.
If you're out front in a tent, you're pretty much on the doorstep, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, but that would, you know, that would be too logical.
That's on the other side of the fence.
You know, Scott, here the thing about this that just drives me absolutely bonkers is there are some tremendous people who work in government. I'm not going to dispute that for a second. There are some tremendous people who work in government, but there are a sufficient number of people who get paid very handsomely, who don't do a whole heck of a lot, who have unbelievable job security, who have benefits and pensions coming out the wazoo, and they can't go back to the office 3 days a week. And you know why, according to the head of the Public Service Union? Because it puts the services Canadians depend on at risk. People working at work is putting our services at risk. How horrible must our federal public service be that doing your job is putting our services at risk? And not doing your job, or at least doing it from far away, makes things better. It's unbelievable. I was feeling happy today until I heard this crap. And it was like, you know what it's time for, Scott? It's time for a culling of the herd, honestly.
When you've expanded by 40%, maybe that's needed. But, you know, that was his economic policy, was increase immigration, increase the size of everything. You get more people in, that'll drive the economy. However, he never thought about healthcare, the houses or the shelter system or any of that.
Yeah, but all the growth in jobs, which is supposed to grow your economy, is all in the public service, which doesn't grow the economy. It simply grows the amount we have to pay in taxes. Honestly, I am not an advocate for widespread firings. I am not. But I do hope, I sincerely hope.
What are you doing in the media then?
I do hope that if and when Pierre Poilievre wins, that one of the first things he will do is say, for the next, I don't know, the term of our first term in office, we have a hiring freeze and we are going to allow for attrition. And if
you know that is going to happen, but I've had professors on here from Mac that have said, well, you know, Harper reduced the size of the civil service. So all Justin Trudeau was just bringing those people back.
Yeah. And
as we digitize our world.
And so look, I love when we compare all these different prime ministers because the world is a different place every time someone takes over. We are not in this. We now have a $1.3 trillion debt. We have a deficit that is spending more to service our debt than the entire cost we're spending on healthcare in this country every year. We have to find some ways to save some money, and an exploding federal civil service is not helping that. And so again, I'm
especially when the performance isn't there. Like we remember, and I remember talking to a prof, well, we remember what happened with the passports and yes. Yeah, but wait a sec. That was after they hired the people. That wasn't due to a shortage. That was after they went on their hiring spree.
Some attrition would be a choice. Right. So you're not putting people out of work. You're saying mm-hmm. if you retire, if you leave, we're not replacing you. And guess what? If you choose to stay, like everybody in the entire private sector, yes, we are going to ask you to do a little more for your pay. That's called life. You've done that. I've done that. I bet you everybody in the private sector who's listening over the last few years has done that. It's not an exceptional thing or an onerous thing to say, you know what? You may have to do a little more. You're being paid well. Deal with it. I think that's totally reasonable.
Wow. Government employees to do more. Good luck with that one. All right. Scott Radley Show coming up after the 5 o'clock news. He is fired up. You can also read him in your Hamilton Spectator. Have a good one, Scott.
Where's Ronald Reagan when you need him? Air traffic controllers.
All right. Have a good one, dude.
Thanks for listening to the Hamilton Today podcast. You can listen to the show live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 on 900 CHML and online at 900CHML.com.
That's it for us. Thanks for listening. As always, we leave it to you, the taxpaying customer, to have the last word. Our last word comes from Mr. Lowe, former teacher and Matt grad. Students camped out and protesting. Listen carefully. Why were you not out protesting after the October 7th Hamas attack that killed 1,200 people at a music concert, many of them similar in age to you? School is over. Exams are done. Let those who earned their degree and graduate in peace and respect. Pack up the tents, pick up your garbage, head back home to your family, and start your summer jobs. Done. Mr. Lowe, Matt grad. Keep right except to pass.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.